Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. I'm talking with Paul Stanton, president of East Tennessee State University, himself a surgeon and former dean of the medical school here, and we're discussing a book called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Uncertain Science. Paul, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wonder if you would begin by giving the listener your sense of what Atul Gawande is trying to say in this book, Complications.
Yeah, first of all, I think that Dr. Gawande, and I've not met him, but I think he's a very mature writer, particularly for this stage in his own training. He's a senior surgical resident at the time of writing this book. Most surgical residents are pretty much solely focused on how you learn to do a certain procedure and what is the outcome of that procedure, how good you're getting at performing it. And sometimes don't back up and look at the overall picture, and that is the other impacts on the patient or his or her family. And I think that Gawande is probably helped by some background, as he tells us, in philosophy and ethics, as well as public health. I think he looks at a broader picture. I think what he's trying to tell us here is that surgeons aren't perfect, that error is human. But the fact of it is, he says very clearly in one of his passages that while a surgeon cannot be perfect, he should always strive to be as close to it as possible. And I think that Atul is telling us that whether the reader is another physician or a layperson, that there are going to be mistakes. There are going to be times in which there is not a clear understanding of disease processes, particularly when we get into areas in this book about nausea, blushing, some of these things that he writes here about. Those are very complex mechanisms. He writes about the complexities, therefore, that are there. But he also seems to indicate that a well-trained physician and surgeon ought to have, at least be expected to have, a certain level of understanding about these things. He also indicates that very clearly that every surgeon for the rest of his or her life will be learning new techniques. And how do you practice? How do you learn those techniques? How do you bring them back to the operating room when you're really practicing still in continuum on a live human being? I think he has a very good understanding that this isn't a perfect world.
If you were going to identify what you see as the major strengths and weaknesses of the book, what would you identify? What would you pick out?
Well, I believe that he indicates that there are basically three ways in which things can go wrong. One of them, from a standpoint of ignorance, has the surgeon not kept up? Has the surgeon not read, not studied how things should be done? Has the surgeon not learned the new techniques? That's ignorance. Then he talks about ineptitude as another category, and that's where you've done the studies, you've done the technique practicing, but then you don't apply them properly, so you have a bad outcome. And then he mentions the third tier, and that's the natural necessary fallibility. Again, the surgeon isn't perfect, and there are times in which there's going to be an error made, no matter how hard he or she tries to do the job well, no matter how much time he or she might have spent in the learning and training process. And I think that's a very strong point that he's making, is the distinction of those three tiers or levels.
So you think he's right on in identifying, saying something important about the practice of medicine, and moreover, giving us this way of understanding different ways in which physicians or the very practice of medicine may be an inexact science.
Right. And he spends some time also talking about the length of time it takes in surgical training, the formal period of residency. in which you have to spend so many waking hours trying to learn new procedures that get more complex each year you're in training. You may start, for instance, learning how to do simple appendectomies or herniorrhaphies, but by the time you finish with your training, you're all the way up to major pulmonary resections or coronary bypasses. And I think he has a good understanding as a senior resident as to what it takes technically to get the learning accomplished. So that's well stated in his book.
Maybe we ought to talk about each of those three elements. And I, one of the reasons I wanted you in the show is I thought that your position, not only as a surgeon, but having been dean of the medical school, that you would particularly be concerned about each of these elements,
right,
and what you might do as dean to try to lessen the chance, at least,
right,
that these would influence the outcomes of physicians who come out of this program. So maybe let's talk about each of them. What would you say about ignorance, what the sources of ignorance are, and what can individual physicians and perhaps a medical school do to remedy those?
Yeah. Well, at the formal training level, the experience that a person goes through during the 5 or 6 years after medical school, we all spend 4 years in medical school, and then after that, standardized general surgery residency programs are 5 years in length. Many offer a 6-year if you're to do a year in the research laboratory. If you're going to subspecialize, let's say do cardiac surgery, that will add another 3 years or so to the 5 or 6 I've already mentioned. Now, during that period of time, during those 5 or 6 postgraduate years, if you will, it's a very intensive learning opportunity. And when I say opportunity, it's not for everyone. And I don't mean just seeing blood smelling excrement, that sort of thing. It's tough because it takes every day of those years to learn what I would consider to be a minimum amount. And when we hear about the call schedule and residents staying on call so long that they may make mistakes because they're sleepy or overstressed, all those things are true. And I certainly support the lessening of the intensity of hours. On the other hand, you still have a fixed amount of information that has to be learned. So there will be some point we will get to, I believe, in which as the hours of call or days on call are reduced, that we're going to add another year of surgical training simply to get in the level of work and the level of understanding that's to be expected. Now, residents in training are tested in many ways daily, but officially they're tested with an in-service exam on an annual basis. And then at the end of the training, let's say in general surgery, there will be a major board exam. And in most cases, both a written exam, and then if you pass that, an oral exam. So you are tested to see if you have learned what is the expected amount of material before you are licensed and boarded, if you will, in a surgical area. My concern is more in the area of ignorance with how well surgeons keep up once their formal training is over. As I say, that's tested so frequently that if an institution, say at the Quillen College of Medicine, is doing its job, you're going to know whether a student has learned the material well or poorly. And if they're learning poorly, at least in our case here, that resident will be dropped from the program somewhere around the end of the 2nd year. So, but beyond that, let's say an individual surgeon does receive his boards and is practicing, and he's 10 years, 15 years out. Is he keeping up with the literature? Because I'm told that if you knew everything the day you finished your residency, the half-life of what you know relative to the new things coming online drops by about 50% every 2 years. So it's a huge volume of new things, new technologies coming about. So is that surgeon reading as often, as frequently, as much as he needs to? And then if there's a new technique, let's say, as in the case, the shoulder ice hernia repair, if a surgeon wants to do that repair, he's going to have to learn it someplace. And if it were developed after his training period, then he's going to have to go to the shoulder ice clinic or some other setting where he can see and actually learn that particular repair of hernias. And then he's going to have to go back when he operates on his own patients, he, in essence, is still in a practice type of learning experience, because he probably will have spent just a few days at the shoulder ice clinic learning their technique. But ignorance, I think, is more likely to be in the keeping up of the material after the formal residency training period.
Okay, so the nature of medical school itself and residency programs tends to be sufficient to ensure that people who leave residency are not ignorant.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I'm very comfortable with the way the testing is done, the supervision is done of residents nowadays in training. It hasn't always been that way. There was a period of time, probably prior to the 60s, maybe 70s, in which particularly in charity-type hospitals, as they were called, there was very poor supervision. Now, by the letter of the law, there has to be an attending surgeon in the room or at least close by for every procedure that's done. And so I think supervision now is much better than it used to be.
There really are two different forms of ignorance, though clearly they're very deeply related. One would be just basic information that you might need to know about a disease, about how to diagnose a disease. But the other that you've talked about are certain skills
right.
that you need in actually being able to diagnose a disease and or to treat the disease and or to do a surgery. Is ignorance, when it is a problem, is it more likely to be a problem in the former case with just the brute information, or in the latter case, lacking the appropriate skills?
Probably the former case, because, again, I come back to keeping up with the academics, if you will, of things in the surgical realm and arena, and those are done through readings of journals, knowing what is being found and how diagnoses are being made. The diagnostic element has changed dramatically over the last few years. The technologies available, for instance, just in the case of prostatic carcinoma, which is a major problem in men in this country. The PSA, the prostatic antigen that we now go by in helping us diagnose that particular cancer, wasn't even available prior to a decade or so ago. If a surgeon were not, or a physician were not, reading and keeping up, they wouldn't even know what PSA would stand for. So that's just a small example of what should be learned in day-to-day reading.
I want to continue the second half of the show discussing some other themes here. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Paul Stanton, president of East Tennessee State University, himself a surgeon and former dean of the medical school here. And we're discussing complications, a surgeon's notes on an uncertain science. The one thing that you've emphasized, which I noted when I read the book, in fact, it is probably something I felt I really learned, was thinking about the way in which training is not something that happens once in your career and then you never have to do it again. The training is ongoing. And you yourself were mentioning a moment ago that as you learn new techniques, you may go to a clinic, you may learn the techniques in the clinic, but you have to go back and try them on a patient. And it's an interesting problem, because if you're a patient, you don't want to be the first patient
right.
on which that new procedure is tried, even if it's a better procedure. Do you, as a physician, should the physician explain to the patient that you're the first time I've tried this procedure, point out what the possible downside would be of trying the procedure when you're relatively untrained?
Sure. I believe that every physician ought to be very honest with the patient. If I had just learned a new surgical technique, I would indicate to the patient that this is a new technique. here are the positives of why we want to learn the technique, why I went to California to take the course, so to speak, or wherever it would have been offered, and that that I'm new at doing it. I would tell them that. Then if they wanted to go further, well, how much training did you get out there, and what was it like? You feel you're competent in doing it? First of all, I wouldn't do it on the patient, if you will, if I didn't feel a certain level of competency. I would go back and take more courses, do more test procedures. But once I felt I were competent, even if it's my first time to do it on that on a particular patient, I would still be honest with that patient, as I would want a physician to be honest with me. Now, most patients, if you explain the procedure, you explain the positives, you explain the negatives, and you always should do that, always explain the negatives, the outcomes, the morbidity, the possible mortality, what are those rates. But most patients will want you to do the procedure if they feel that they can tell from your exchange or interchange with them that you believe you're competent in doing this.
And I assume, too, that you would not only try to say that I'm sufficiently competent to do it on you and to help you, but by your willingness to let me do the procedure on you, other patients in the future will benefit from it.
Yes. And there are some procedures that are done with great frequency. There's some that are done with less frequency. And I've had a number of patients over the years to ask me, well, how many of these do you do every year? And again, I believe in being very honest with them. If they say, well, doc, I don't think that's enough to make me comfortable, where else can I go? Then I refer them. I've never been bothered by referral. I've never been bothered by a second opinion. Again, I think the patient deserves the right answers.
What about this third category, the idea of necessary fallibility? What do you think he means by that? And could you give some examples that you think might illustrate it from your own experience?
Well, he opened his book with a case in which an individual showed up in the emergency room having been shot in the buttocks area. And that normally can have very grave consequences. I have seen patients shot in the same area. Usually there's damage to the colon or to the bladder, as well as other organs. And they acted in good faith. They acted with overall good judgment in exploring the patient. When I was trained, you were told that a penetrating wound to the abdomen, if there's no exit wound, you explored. And you explored them because of the risk of oversight of damage, which could be catastrophic. In this case, explored the individual. There was no damage found at all. And then on a later x-ray of the abdomen, they saw the bullet in a fairly innocuous area. But even if they had taken that x-ray before the exploration, by standard surgical training, you would explore the patient anyway. Now, suppose that patient had died due to the exploration, but the bullet was innocuous. Well, you could say, well, the surgeon failed. He killed the patient. Well, statistically, that is so rare to have a patient to die when you're doing an abdominal exploration. It still should not keep that surgeon from doing the next patient's exploration of the abdomen when he's shot. So I guess what I'm saying there's certain things that cannot be the outcome that you desired or believe would be, but you use the best judgment you can, and there's still going to be a probably a 2 to 4% morbidity and mortality risk, even in the best of hands. You know, I have seen this myself, for instance, doing a carotid endarterectomy, cleaning out the carotid artery to the brain. You do that for certain reasons. You know those reasons. You know when you should do that procedure. And let's say you do it and you follow every standard that you've ever gone by as far as the technique itself, how you do the endarterectomy, how you remove the plaque. And then the patient wakes up with a stroke. And I've had that. That does occur. It occurs probably in about 2% of the cases. So when it does occur, you've done something wrong. but you don't know what. And in most cases, you'll never know what has occurred or gone wrong to cause it. So that's sort of a situation in which you're not ignorant. You've read the books, you've learned the techniques, you've done 1,000 of them, if you will, and there's no ignorance or ineptitude, but something goes awry.
How do you respond as a doctor when that happens? The patient dies even if you've taken all the precautions.
It's very difficult. I can remember almost every face of a patient, many cases the name of the patient, in which I've had something to go wrong. It's hard to be so objective that you can walk away and not have any emotion at all with it. And I think that because of the emotion of you didn't get the results you want, hopefully you'll strive to do everything possible, even better the next time. But with those necessary failings in the surgeon being human, unfortunately, a lot of the time you don't find out what you can do better the next time, but you strive to. If I had a surgeon that didn't care about a number of losses or the number of mishaps, I wouldn't want that surgeon to operate on me.
Okay, so even though there is a certain level of necessary fallibility, the response of a physician shouldn't be to say, well, this was just one of those 2%.
Right. If you get a surgeon that says that, you have a surgeon that has some significant problems in his own right, and you wouldn't want to be operated on by that individual. And I think Gwandi, again, states that in his book very clearly, that a surgeon isn't going to be perfect in all that he does, but he certainly ought to strive for perfection.
And feeling that care, feeling that guilt even is a way of trying to be as perfect as you can be,
yes,
even if you're subject to just that
right.
necessary fallibility.
And I think most physicians that go into surgery, go into surgical training and eventual practice, have that type of makeup. They want to do well. They're not out there just to be able to say, I'm a surgeon, and I'm a real hot dog because of that. There are a few, but most people that are out practicing surgery really want to do a good job, want to be conscientious, and want to have good outcomes.
Okay. I'm wondering if you could try to say a little bit more about how the sort of thing that Gwandi talks about here, the recognition of fallibility, both of the practice and of individual practitioners, how that should shape medical education. Because I know this is a particular concern of yours.
Yeah, well, he also, in one passage of his book, talks a lot about morbidity and mortality conferences, M&Ms. And for a surgeon in training, those are brutal sessions. They're usually held weekly. They're usually chaired by the senior-most faculty member or the chairman of the department. And they're done in such a way that residents, as well as attendings who have had a mishap or a poor outcome, are challenged to explain why. What went wrong? Some cases you can't explain why something went wrong. But if you do, for instance, a colectomy, and you've anastomosed, sewn together the two ends of the bowel, and you develop a surgical leak after the procedure. Well, why did that happen? Could you have done anything better, anything differently the next time to keep this from happening again? And so part of the training all the way through is open up, look at what mistakes you have made. Don't try to cover them up. Look at the mistakes, look at the poor outcomes, and try to day in, day out, procedure after procedure, do better the next time. And so that's part of every surgeon's life. Just every training and teaching hospital will have M&M conferences on a weekly basis.
Okay. And so things like this are things that and perhaps you could have them even for people who are not residents.
Yes.
Would that help?
Okay. Yeah, well, the attendings in a teaching hospital, the one who is in charge of the procedure, whatever the procedure is also expected to be at that conference. and be grilled, if you will, as well as to what went wrong and why.
Do things like this happen at non-teaching hospitals as well?
Oh, certainly. Okay. Yeah, yeah. But the M&M conferences, the morbidity mortality conferences, to a lesser degree than in a teaching hospital.
Are there things that this book could tell just the ordinary person that they ought to know about the practice of medicine? No, is it not asking about physicians reading it, but the rest of us who are just patients. Is this a book that we should read?
Yeah, I think so. I think it indicates very clearly that surgeons want to do and strive to do the best they possibly can. But here are some of the examples, as was in the book, of some poor outcomes. Here are some examples of very good outcomes. And, you know, this is a very realistic book in the writing of it. I would also believe that both physician as well as patient should realize from reading this book that communication needs to be there between the surgeon and his patient. It needs to be open, needs to be candid, and I think it needs to be somewhat protracted. If you come into a surgeon's office and you have a minute or two and that's all, and you know, he says, this is the way it needs to be done, and we've got you on the schedule for tomorrow, that's not enough. 85% of what we probably see in medicine has some relationship to psychology or emotion as far as some underlying significance. Now, it doesn't mean that psychology or emotion has caused an acute appendicitis, but at the same time, if the communication is not there between surgeon and patient, the outcome may not be quite as good because the surgeon needs to know the patient from as many perspectives as possible, including family relationships, work experience. If you've got a bad back, did it come from work? Or is it based on some type of emotional basis at home or otherwise? So there's a lot to patient care besides just this is diagnosis X and we're going to do surgery Y.
So one of the bits of advice perhaps of this book to patients is ask your questions to doctors.
Absolutely.
I mean, ask your doctor questions if you're concerned about a condition or about the treatment.
Yes, and again, a good doctor, a good surgeon is not going to object to having questions raised. I would dare say that that surgeon would ask many questions in his surgeon's office.
Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to Paul Stanton, president of East Tennessee State University and former dean of the medical school. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.